Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. As a psychologist, I'm continually interested in the ways that what someone says, what they do, what they feel, the environments they find themselves in, all these things combine to make someone's experience. And particularly what they say and what they feel, and as humans, what we do, are not always in alignment. And I'm continually interested in understanding the reasons for that. And that's why on the podcast this year, I have been exploring many ways that might be possible. There are ways that we've learned about internal reactions to others, such as resonance and heart rate variability, a nonverbal and non-conscious response to the behaviors of others, as I've been exploring lately about appeasement signals. So many things influence a person's experience. And as someone who started my career early in working with children, I was fortunate to see this in the early years of human development. And I got to witness many times how a child is asked to place their experience into commonly understood language terms that we use. For example, one time I overheard a 3 or 4 year old girl being asked to say what her favorite color was, and she replied, butterfly. And I was glad that the person asking her the question also had trouble understanding what she said at first. So she was asked to repeat it, and she kept saying, butterfly. Butterfly was her favorite color. To this day, that's one of my most favorite understandings of how our brains work at that age. Because I thought to myself, how amazing. She's totally right. Butterfly is an amazing color. That's what a great answer. And I thought, you know, why don't we always speak in pictures and story? I'm not sure. I think it has to do with the fact that as we mature, we have to categorize things in order to learn them better, something along those lines. But when we're in the 3 to 4 year old timeline, most of our functioning in how we think and organize seems to be at these kind of more integrated descriptions of our experiences. And that experience of hearing her describe her favorite color as butterfly informed a lot of the ways that I see how children tell me many things. And in fact, early in my career working with children in that age range, I had to learn each child's own language of how they describe things. And many play therapists will agree with me that that is the therapy, is learning how the child sees their world, how they refer to different pieces of their environment, people, structure, interactions, all these things come out in play behaviors and other statements that don't match very often what we're asking them. For example, asking a child that age to work on coping mechanisms or what their stressors are makes no sense because that's almost like another language. So when I work with kids, actually of any age and even up through the adult years, I've learned that each person has a representation of their own experience that comes out in different ways, different language. And so I want to be learning that and understanding the reasons then for maybe some of their behaviors, some of their thoughts, and some of their feelings, because all these things kind of combine into one experience. And so as a mental health therapist, we can sometimes be working on one area that is not the driving force for the overall integrated experience. And I'm going to do that by considering the topic I've been looking at research about in the last few episodes, and that is appeasement signals. Because in my work with children, I specialize in working with children who have had experience with trauma or some form of abuse. And as I've been researching the articles on appeasement signals, as a reminder, this is the way that animals and humans non-verbally display that we don't want conflict, that we want to be peaceable. And I could not get past the fact, as we learned that, you know, there are dogs that look away and or lick their lips when they want to be displaying their intentions to be peaceable. And this idea that displaying those, a variety and a combination of appeasement signals to lead to the expression of embarrassment kind of engendered trust across social interactions in episodes 43 and 44. And I just haven't been able to get past the fact that I see a lot of these appeasement signals in the children with whom I work, as well as adults who report having experienced abuse when they were children. There's many ways that children and adults who have grown up in what are called chronic trauma households, so repeated trauma, neglect, maybe living with one or more parents or caregivers who use substances. So many of the appeasement signals I've been exploring in recent episodes on the podcast just seem so similar to the things I see in my patients who report these experiences. And even in some young children who don't report the experiences, but where it's known to be happening in their homes. And so I wanted to explore this idea a bit further, because the way I have conceptualized it up until learning about the category of research called appeasement signals is what is really commonly understood in this work, but, well, I should say commonly understood in the sense that it happens a lot, but it is hard to understand. And that is, many children and adults who have a parent who is abusive actually, when given the choice, select to be with that parent. And this is really hard for anyone in their world who's trying to help them, especially like teachers and school counselors, maybe coaches. It's so hard for most people to understand why a child who's experiencing a difficult home life would choose to be there. And as a clinician who's worked in the field for quite a while, I learned, you know, that people love who they love. And when you have an adoration for a parent or a caregiver, it doesn't really always matter how they treat you. I also have learned that in some families, you know, it's kind of like bad attention is better than no attention. It's also just common for humans to get accustomed to a certain environment. But it's more than that to me. In my experience, there is, you know, all people have goodness in them. And what is endearing a lot about the children in these homes is they are certain that their caregivers are good and that it's their job as children to act and behave in a way enough such that that goodness of the parent comes out. And that is where this appeasement behavior research starts to make a lot of sense to me, is they are now talking about this ability for animals to kind of sense other animals and non-verbally signal their intentions. And I got to thinking that this is something that children do that I work with and have observed and seen over the years. And even sometimes it's more helpful to hear an adult reflect back on the many ways that they would assess the home environment, listen for sounds, listen for the tone, and kind of get the sort of temperature of the room, if you will. And a lot of people have distinct memories of hearing the door open after parents get home from work and knowing exactly how the evening is going to go just by the way the parent entered into the home. And they report then adjusting their own behaviors to match that. In other words, if it's an evening where things are going to be okay, or sounds at least like that's possible, then maybe, you know, having a little bit more flexibility. Whereas if it's an evening where things are kind of on the edge, then maybe the intention to come to the dinner table with some funny jokes or be pleasing or calming. Many adults don't realize until they reach maturity how this is ingrained in their behaviors, this sort of uncanny sense of the moods of others and an ability, or at least a hope, that one can direct the behaviors of others through their own activities. And while it's not been often called appeasement behaviors per se in the field of working with children who have experienced abuse, I just had a feeling that somebody had to have thought similarly to me, that there's an uncanny resemblance between the ways we're seeing how animals behave when they want to be peaceable and the ways how humans behave when they want to display peaceableness, that might have a further implication for children who've been raised in traumatic households. And sure enough, I found a study that is talking about this, so I'm going to introduce it. And they actually go over a few things that tie in different areas that I've explored on the podcast. So we'll kind of walk through this sort of slowly so that we can go back and look at the many ways this contributes to our larger understanding of working with children in these circumstances, and kind of piece together the steps there, integrating them into this idea of appeasement signals. And as a result, this topic is going to be broken into two episodes so that we can take our time and really integrate all of these steps. So the article is actually a paper this time that contributes to the understanding for the field by summarizing and integrating some other studies. It's called Entrapped Mother, Entrapped Child, Agonic Mode, Hierarchy, and Appeasement in intergenerational abuse and neglect. I'll say it one more time. Entrapped mother, entrapped child, agonic mode, hierarchy and appeasement in intergenerational abuse and neglect. It's published in the Journal of Child and Family Studies in 2015, and the authors are Jackie Amos, Leonie Segal, and Chris Cantor. And right off the bat, the title itself needs a lot of explanation. So I'll kind of highlight different parts of the theories that they are integrating. They're integrating more theories than I'm going to summarize here. So as always, we'll have the information about this study in the show notes and on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. But first, I just want to tie some things together that I have mentioned either in this episode or in previous ones. And that is, they have this interesting way of describing what I just said that I feel like summarizes a similar understanding of children in these circumstances in terms of the need to be constantly aware of the tone or the temperature in the room and have that be something that becomes a facet of the child's personality and kind of overall makeup, is that having to use that skill so much in childhood actually comes at the expense of other things. You're not as playful. Things are not as fluid. You have a less likelihood for novelty, and you kind of approach people that you meet for the first time with suspicion because of this. And they explain, the authors say, quote, "The price the child pays to belong in the relationship," that is the relationship with the mother in this case, they are looking at children and mothers, quote, "The price the child pays to belong in the relationship is the need to pay constant, vigilant, and anxious attention to the mother's moods and behaviors in order to remain alert to shifts." So they're summarizing there what I was just highlighting, that is that it actually is sort of costly energetically in a way, or just at the expense of other behaviors the child could be doing, to develop the ability to have this sense about the mother in this example and her moods and behaviors and the shifts, in order for the child to then come to a reaction to those moods and shifts that can increase the child's safety and increase the child's ability to continually interact with the mother. And I think it's fascinating. And it actually, they're going to quote Mary Mayne here, which I have covered on the podcast in multiple episodes in detail on episode number 4 and then again in episode 11. And what they're going to describe is how the child learns to behave in order to see if their needs can be met in an unpredictable environment. And they summarize Mayne and Cassidy's research by saying, quote, "Even when the mother's behavior toward the child is placating, pleading, and submissive, the child must appease the mother in whatever way is possible to remain in close proximity to her and feel some sense of safety. The child with the abdicating mother may behave in a contemptuous, dominant, hostile fashion, taking charge and dispensing advice. The child with a distressed and overtly anxious mother may find that caregiving behavior appeases the mother's anxiety, and the child of the depressed mother may clown and entertain," end quote. So what's happening here is we're getting some pictures in our mind about how children work really hard to stay in relationship to their caregivers. And even when the caregiver is in a variety of moods, the child must sort of shift to be able to stay in some kind of relationship to the mother. is the thinking here. And it is something I have observed. And again, I mean, people love their loved ones, you know? So it's not to say that this is only something that happens in concerning and situations. This is something we're always doing, as we're seeing in the appeasement signals work and even some of the other work on nonverbals. There are ways that we are continually, as social creatures, trying to keep some sort of balance in the social structure of our groups so that we can continue to interact and interrelate with other members of that group. And we just see it more distinctly here from the perspective of a child who's having to navigate the variety of behaviors they might display in response to a parent who is unpredictable and at times dangerous. And then another thing they describe that can happen for children, which I do see all the time, is that when a child is raised in an environment where threat and unpredictability are the norm, then a lot of times children will, that the anxiety of waiting for what will happen is difficult. And so sometimes we see the children be the ones to act out. And that's actually how I get to meet a lot of the children I am able to work with, is that it's overwhelming to wait for the outcome of what might happen. For in the example I said at the beginning of, you know, what happens when someone comes home from work. And so the instinct then becomes to control that, at least to remove the uncertainty, to control it in ways by acting out and getting a more predictable response, even if it's a punishment or something for acting out. And the authors of this study summarize that this is common, and like I have seen, where the child will actually feel threatened by the lack of predictability. And they say further that the responses will be incomprehensible to others and may, quote, this is all their quote here, may draw forth familiar hostile or helpless responses, which will paradoxically increase their sense of safety but alienate them from the group. And this is so disturbing to watch, but so common. And that is a child who is used to unpredictability, but really wants to know, like all of us do, if we're in a safe environment or how the others in our social group are going to behave. And so in occasion, they will get used to being the one to instigate the sort of chaos in the relationship or the hostility in the relationship, so that at least the anxiety is removed, which, as these authors say, paradoxically increases their sense of safety. But especially in like school-aged children, where they're trying to figure out groups at school or working with teachers and other adults, when they take this very learned behavior of how to take control of the situation into other social groups, they often get alienated from the group because that group may not have expected their hostile response, for example. And so then the group is kind of like, you know, not understanding the hostility from this child, but it makes total sense for the child to sort of, especially, you know, first day of school, first week of school, there's a lot of unpredictability. So there's a way in which people need to reduce that. And this is one way that children in these circumstances do. And the sad reality is that it tends to isolate them from other groups they might meet. And I see that all the time. And I was introduced to this idea by Bessel van der Kolk. You may be aware, Bessel van der Kolk wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score. He does a lot of research with his team at the Trauma Research Foundation. He is a psychiatrist who is based in Boston and started that foundation so that they could do research, train clinicians, and in general, just get out some of this information to the public at large so that we could understand the many ways trauma impacts all humans and how some, in this case, for example, how some of these behaviors can be misunderstood. And for people like myself, provides a way to understand how to treat and intervene in these situations. I was fortunate to be at an agency when I was doing my postdoctoral training, and we were invited to work with Dr. Vanderkolk's team to do some of this research. And so I was firsthand able to see what we were seeing in the clinic where I worked and how that related to the research we did and contribute to some of this really important things he's doing at this foundation. And that was an amazing experience in and of itself. But one thing that is striking to how it ties to what we're talking about is Dr. Vanderkolk is proposing a new disorder called developmental trauma disorder, which would be reflective of children's experiences like the ones I'm describing. So his idea is to reduce the tendency for many children in this circumstance to receive diagnoses based on their behaviors, like the ones I just described, where the behaviors can be hostile. So he's hoping to reduce the tendency for children to receive diagnoses based on those type of behaviors and instead to have a diagnosis that is more descriptive of their experience and helps us understand that those behaviors are in the context of a much larger system and environment. And this is also related to something we learned from Stephen Porges that I've reviewed on the podcast, where he explained that one thing children who have been maltreated or institutionalized typically do is display a defensive response to social bonding. And to me, this is part of that, where you see a lot of times, you know, a child maybe is removed from the home or even in the school environment is, you know, provided with interventions, maybe extra supports from teachers and coaches. And there become the reports that the child is not responding to these attempts of the social bonding. And I think of it as directly related to what we're talking about here, is that the child may very much want to be part of a social group and bond, but their experience up to that point suggests that they have to kind of push the boundaries and see what people are capable of. And in order to do that, appearing hostile is one way to see what others will do in the face of hostility. In the children I have supported in this circumstance, it seems to be that there's just, as the author suggested, so much risk in waiting for what the other person is going to do that there's like a wish to understand it and be able to maneuver as a result, that they determine their safest or their best chance for survival is to go ahead and initiate a hostile action to, you know, sort of understand what others are capable of and how they would react. So I'm appreciating the authors of this article for bringing us to this point, and we will pick up where they're going to discuss appeasement behaviors specifically in the next episode. Thanks a lot. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.